end in sight for the U.S.-China trade war.
You've got two sides which have conceptions of this conflict that lean more towards confrontation than towards resolution.
Also on the show, it starts on the American East Coast, goes across the Atlantic to Europe, and on to the Arabian Peninsula.
This is the cycle of weapons that is allowing all of the human rights abuses in Yemen and continues the war.
We hear about an effort to block that flow. I'm Marco Werman. We're also taking a new look at solar energy.
It doesn't make sense. Why are we transporting electricity large distances when it costs so much to do so, when we can just generate that electricity at the home where it's being used in the first place?
All that and more today here on The World. It didn't seem very provocative. A 17-year-old girl in Moscow reads from a book. Police in riot gear surround her. What she's reading is part of the Russian Constitution that says Russian citizens have the right to peacefully protest. A bit later, the girl is arrested. It is hard being part of the political opposition in Russia, but something there is happening. Last weekend, huge demonstrations in Moscow ended with hundreds of arrests. More protests are expected this weekend. These demonstrations are all about the upcoming municipal elections in the capital, yet the Russian government's response to protests has been fierce. Right now, nearly all of the opposition candidates running in Moscow city elections are in jail.
Yeah, it's like a huge persecution campaign happening currently.
Nikita Kulenchenkov is a Russian opposition activist pushing for change from outside the country. He's with the Anti-Corruption Foundation, a group that's been calling for protests in Moscow.
There were over 1,000 people arrested just during the day of the protests, which means that there were at least like 10 or 15,000 people on the street, which is quite a lot. Also, something like 100, I don't know the exact number, maybe a bit less, were arrested and are still in the detention. What is more shocking about that all of those candidates were arrested. I think 80% of them are now in the detention, and they all got something like 1 month term in the detention for participating or for calling for protests. Now the authorities started a criminal case.
Criminal case is against whom?
Against the people who participated in those mass riots. But at that moment, they selected like 4 or 5 people who were seen on the video making any kind of interaction with the policeman, except by being beaten by policemen.
Nikita, you're not in Russia. You reside in Lithuania. How'd you end up there? And is it dangerous for you to go back home to Moscow?
Yeah, it's dangerous for me to go back in Moscow because I'm going to be arrested in the border and put into the detention for unknown period of time.
You're certain that would happen if you went back?
Well, yeah, I'm on the federal wanted list, I'm pretty sure.
And is it true that was all over a stolen poster?
Oh, yeah, you know the story. That's about the stolen poster, which happened 5 years ago, back in 2014. The authorities saw that we got this poster. We actually took that. I was not the only person who were accused of stealing the poster, right. But the local artist who was drawing those posters on the social topics, he was putting them on the walls of the buildings around the city for many years. The offer valued it for $5, and the authorities make a number of evaluations, and finally one evaluation they got was that it's enough to start the criminal case. I left Russia like in 2014, and then I was on the Interpol wanted list. I was arrested, and lots of interesting things happened.
Nikita, you work a lot with Alexei Navalny, probably the best-known opposition leader, but you're not in Moscow. What's it been like seeing your friends and colleagues getting thrown in prison?
Well, unfortunately, you get used to it. I spent some days in the prison, too. It seems that the Russian authorities, they are pretty clever, and they now use the tactics of that short arrest. Like, Alexei spent 1/4 of the year in the detention, so he got arrested like once in 2 months for 1 month, which definitely affects his health, which affects our like operations, that affects our morale, not his, I think.
And he's in prison now too, right? I mean, allegedly he's been poisoned. Have you been in touch with him, and is he talking about that?
he submitted a complaint to the police in Russia that he was poisoned, because before that, like when he was sent back from the hospital to the prison, he was like a bit skeptical about that. Now it seems that he changed his mind and thinks that he was somehow poisoned.
So, Nikita, this weekend, by default, is going to be a leaderless protest because most of the main opposition leaders are in prison. What are you hopeful for right now?
Looking at this situation, I hope that the local Russian authorities, the Moscow authorities, will change their mind and understand that the bigger problem is with the protests rather than the independent candidates running for the election.
Nikita Kulichenkov, an investigator there with the Anti-Corruption Foundation. He spoke with us from our BBC studio in London. Getting a passport seems pretty basic, but if you're a woman in Saudi Arabia, it's actually complicated, partly because Saudi women first needed to get permission from a male guardian. That's changing now. The Saudi government has approved an amendment that will begin to allow women to apply for passports without the permission of that male guardian. The news got mixed reviews on social media, with the kingdom's ambassador to the U.S. tweeting that she was elated, but some activists fighting for women's rights in the region are saying not so fast. Inez Osman is the director of MENA Rights. The group promotes human rights in the Middle East and North Africa. She joins us from Geneva. Saudi Arabia has what's called guardianship rules. Could you just, first of all, briefly explain what those are, Inez?
There are several guardianship laws, and some of them have been amended, then allowing women over the age of 21 to apply for passport or travel without permission. This is obviously a positive move and the biggest blow ever, actually, to the male guardianship system. However, women continue to face numerous restrictions under this male guardianship system, and they still need the approval of their male guardian to marry, for example, or live on their own, even to leave prison after they serve their sentence. So although some restrictions have been lifted, we still have a bunch of measures in place that restrict the freedom of women at the moment.
What was your reaction when you heard the announcement yesterday?
In March of this year, actually, Saudi Arabia had pledged before the United Nations Human Rights Council to abolish fully the male guardianship system. So my reaction was that, well, this is great and this is better than nothing, but we're certainly hoping for other measures to be taken with regards to women's rights, and this is not enough.
So if these new rules are in fact implemented, what will be the new normal for women in Saudi Arabia?
In recent months, we've seen several young women who have fled the country and made, you know, public pleas on social media for help in seeking asylum from their family and the government. So one wonders, are more women going to flee their country? What's going to happen?
I mean, there has been an outpouring of, I don't know any other word, but emotion in the wake of this rule change, the announcement of it. What's been the reaction to those advocating for human rights in Saudi Arabia?
Everybody remembers when the ban on women driving was lifted last year. But we activists believe that these measures are just for show and that Mohammed bin Salman is actively shutting down any form of peaceful dissent and actually has no intention of implementing real reforms. This was quite evident in May of last year when there was a wave of arrest of women human rights defenders. And the irony is that these women had long been advocating for such measures and for the male guardianship to be abolished. So these women are basically seen as a threat because if they were free, they would be challenging this modernist narrative that Saudi is trying to present to the world today.
So what do you think is next for the kingdom? I mean, are you at least hopeful that these rule change proposals at least are the beginning of real change?
Ultimately, if Saudi Arabia is serious about improving the situation of women and human rights in the country, these women human rights defenders should be released unconditionally. And one thing also, last but not least, is that we've been talking a lot about the women, but let's not forget that there are also men who are currently in prison because they have been advocating for gender equality and equal rights, and they haven't gotten any attention.
Inez Osman, the director of the Middle East and North Africa Human Rights Association, MENA Rights, speaking with us from Geneva. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Saudi Arabia and its partner, the United Arab Emirates, are big buyers of U.S. weapons. President Trump wants to keep it that way. He's vetoed congressional attempts to stop the sale of smart bombs to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. A group of U.S. lawmakers want to ban weapon sales because of how they're being used in the war in Yemen. But Trump says military hardware sales mean American jobs. In Europe, there's another effort to stop the flow of weapons to Yemen. The World's Stephen Snyder has been taking a deep dive into this arms trade. So the war in Yemen is now in its fifth year, Stephen. Tell us about this pipeline of weapons flowing into Yemen.
Well, it's not actually a pipeline. I found this out. It's actually boats. There are five cargo ships that are owned by Saudi Arabia. One comes up the U.S. East Coast every 25 days. Then it goes up to New Brunswick, where it picks up light armored vehicles made by the Canadians, then taken across the ocean to ports of call in Europe, and then back down to the Arabian Peninsula.
And there is a fantastic map that you've put up on our website, theworld.org, that shows exactly this route. So I want to talk to you about what's been going on in Europe with this attempt to stop the flow of arms from the United States to Yemen.
I spoke with Brian Kastner, who's at Amnesty International, and he cited something called the UN Arms Trade Treaty.
The standard in the arms trade treaty is that you should not be transferring the weapons or selling the weapons if there is a risk of them being used for human rights abuses.
But didn't President Trump kind of unsign that treaty this year?
Yes, he did in April at the NRA. Famously, he took the pen that he'd unsigned it with and threw it out into the audience to great acclaim. But other countries like France and Italy, they say they uphold the UN arms trade treaty. They've signed it and they ratified it.
So tell us what's been going on in Europe now with these arms shipments to Yemen.
Well, European activists, they learned about the boats. They're owned by the Bahri company. It's owned by Saudi Arabia. The word had got out that the Bahri ships had been picking up armored vehicles in Canada. They'd been picking up ammunition in Antwerp, and they were going to be stopping at ports in France and Spain and Italy. One of the activists that I spoke to was a man named Emmerich Elouin.
When I learned that we have the risk to see a Saudi vessel loaded weapon in a French port, I made an alert Twitter message, and the reaction was immediate.
Protesters showed up at the dock at Le Havre. They kept these truck-mounted artillery from being loaded. Then the cargo ship was scheduled to go to Italy next, and the activists got together there with longshoremen, dock workers. They went to the port at Genoa.
For the first time, the dock workers decided to organize with NGOs, and they say, no, that we will not work for the war in the Yemen.
Yeah, that's Tina Marinari, and she made a big point about longshoremen, NGOs, and peace activists working together at the port there. That was kind of a new thing.
Mm. So that other activist we heard from, I mean, seriously organized and somehow watching the seas and knowing all this information. How on earth do these activists find out which ship is going where and what it's supposed to be picking up?
This is like the internet age. It's wonderful because you can track it on your laptop. Maritime trackers, the same software that shows you where oil tankers are in the Strait of Hormuz, will also tell you where these vessels are.
Activists have these same tools here in the United States. Could these protests happen here? Are they even starting?
Probably not anytime soon. I spoke with Medea Benjamin. She is an anti-war activist, co-founder of the group Code Pink. She's written a book about the U.S.-Saudi connection, and we see her leading protests at weapons makers like Raytheon. But she says her organization has not gone to U.S. ports like Wilmington, North Carolina, where U.S. weapons are loaded onto Saudi cargo ships.
We feel that while we should be organizing around the Bahri ships, it's also another example of a symbolic protest because they're going to get the weapons on those ships in another way.
Where Code Pink is focusing is instead on the congressional effort, on the politics of it.
The World's Stephen Snyder, thanks very much for the reporting on this.
Thanks. My pleasure.
You can find out more about the cargo ships and the routes they take at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Indonesian government will close Komodo Island, home to the world's largest lizard, the Komodo dragon. The island is a huge tourist attraction, gets about 300,000 visitors a year. But the governor of the region says the place is being overrun by tourists, some of whom are involved in poaching and smuggling the lizards. Komodo dragons are listed as vulnerable on a list of threatened species. Closing the island is meant to allow conservationists help restore the animal's habitat to what it once was. But if this shutdown happens, even villagers who have lived with the lizards for generations will be forced to leave Komodo Island. The BBC's Rebecca Henschke reports.
You've got some cold water here if you like, folks.
It's a beautiful morning here on Komodo Island, and a huge cruise ship has come into the bay, and off it is a stream of tourists from around the world.
Incoming, 3,000 people.
Abdul Ghaffour is one of the many local Komodo guides waiting for them.
It's like looking for the Komodo dragon, like the dinosaurus. Like a Komodo dragon, yeah, like the superstar.
The Komodo dragons that grow up to 3 meters long and weigh up to 85 kilograms hiss at each other and seemingly ignore the crowd around them. The fact that their bite can be deadly to humans is for many, like Herman Ataman from Turkey, part of the attraction.
My husband told me there's a dragon like this. I didn't believe him. But when we got the tickets, when I came, it is true. So beautiful. It's scary too.
The number of visitors coming here has doubled in the last 5 years to 300,000. Today, there are so many people in the jungle that crowd management is needed.
Each tour group rolls in and is given 5 minutes to take photos and then is told to leave as the next one comes.
With increased interest and money coming in, a tussle has broken out over control of this World Heritage Site. The central government is heavily promoting the area and wants to see 500,000 visitors this year. The local government says it's unsustainable.
Karena banyak sekali orang masuk di sana, lalu
anyone can come in and out, says the governor of the region, Victor Leskodak, and they're paying next to nothing. He's demanding a year-long closure of the island, and then after that, a limited number of people who can pay $1,000 each can come in, he says. Earlier this year, police arrested 5 people for smuggling baby Komodo dragons. And the governor says this is a further sign that things are out of control.
There will be no smuggling under my watch. It's called Komodo Island, so it will only be for the Komodos, not for humans. There will be no human rights there, only animal rights. Whoever disturbs the dragons will be fed to them, and they will die.
He's also talking about genetically modifying the dragons to make them even bigger. And under his controversial plan, the community of around 2,000 people that lives on Komodo Island will be relocated. They speak their own language, Komodo, and have lived with the dragons for generations.
The villagers here say that they let their goats roam around free rather than putting them in any form of a cage overnight and in the day, because they're kind of their protection against the Komodo dragons. If they come in, they'll take the goats instead of the children.
The community also says they're protected because they're related to the dragons. Elder Haji Amin, like most Indonesians, is a devout Muslim. But this is our history, he says, not a legend, that Princess Nago gave birth to a man-child and a Komodo baby. So we're connected with the dragons by blood. And moving, he says, is not an option.
Wow. We will be better off dead. They tried to move us in the 70s when they declared this area a national park, and the Komodos went crazy. They started jumping into the sea and swimming away. That's how close our relationship is. We will fight to stay.
The BBC's Rebecca Henschke brought us that story. Government officials from Myanmar traveled to Bangladesh this week. They met Rohingya refugees there who had fled to Bangladesh following a brutal military crackdown that began in 2017. The officials handed out flyers to the refugees aimed at persuading them to come home. Myanmar's controversial repatriation plan involves a pathway to citizenship for Rohingya Muslims, but they would be forced to live in a refugee camp while their homes and villages are rebuilt. Ne San Win is the campaign coordinator of the Free Rohingya Coalition. He joined us from Frankfurt, Germany. I asked him if Myanmar's repatriation plan has changed since it was first proposed last year.
Their offer is the same as before. They have not changed anything yet. they are offering the national verification card, which is designed for the immigrant from a foreign country. And after we accept the national verification card, there is the chance to get the naturalized citizenship. Since we are the indigenous people belong to Rakhine State, we cannot accept this naturalized citizenship. They are trying to erase our existence and our history. So we have been rejecting it. All the refugees, they refuse to go. Because, you know, if they go back to Rakhine State, they have to accept this national verification card and they will not be allowed to go back to their original houses.
Where do people go if their homes are no longer there?
The government has built the camp nearby the border. The refugees have to go to the reception center where they will issue the national verification card. Then they will have to stay in the camp. The government is saying they can build their own houses in the villages, but this thing are not really going to happen. I am in Germany. I have visited the many memorial of the concentration camp here, like Dachau. The design of the camp at the Myanmar and Bangladesh border, I found that the same here in Germany with the watchtower and the barbed wire. So it will be like a concentration camp.
There was an earlier attempt to repatriate Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh last year, but many people were scared, really scared to return. Are Rohingya still worried about returning to Myanmar?
Yes, because that cycle of violence has been repeating again and again since 1978. In 1978, about 250,000 had to flee to Bangladesh, and they were repatriated a few months later. Again, this happened in 1991, 1992. So there is no guarantee that this persecution will stop. People are really afraid. That is why they want to assure full citizenship. And also the people are asking the international protection until this ongoing genocide is ended.
Can Myanmar win back the trust of the Rohingya people?
I don't think, because, you know, there are a lot of propaganda against the Rohingya still, you know, the government is making. This is the policy of the Burmese government to persecute all the ethnic minorities. Unless, you know, they change their system, we can't trust them. And because of their propaganda, the majority really believe that we are invading the country. We are from Bangladesh because of our skin color, our faith. 3-4 days ago, the Malaysian Prime Minister said either you treat them as national or give them a chance to form their own state in their own territory. We will not demand our own independent country. But if in a few years, Myanmar keep rejecting our rights, if Myanmar keep us in the camp in Bangladesh, we will not have other alternative than seeking our own state.
Ne San Huynh, the campaign coordinator of the Free Rohingya Coalition. Very good to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
At theworld.org and on your radio, you're with the world. When your smart device speaks to you, the accent of that voice might be important.
Your destination will be on the right.
A new local accent for Google Maps in Nigeria and new battery storage technology could be a game changer in solar energy. Rethinking the electric grid for the 21st century. That's all still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. U.S. and Chinese trade negotiators met in Shanghai this week and said they had a positive dialogue, a good sign in this ever-escalating trade war. But what has followed is the same old war of words. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
For decades, China has taken advantage of trade, taken advantage of trade versus the United States of America, and taken advantage of trade versus countries in Asia and Southeast Asia. And it's time for that to stop.
And here's Hua Chunying from the Chinese Foreign Ministry. She responded to President Trump's call for these new tariffs on Chinese goods. If the U.S. adds new tariffs, she says, China will have to take necessary countermeasures. So what's that going to look like? Patrick Chivanek is chief strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management. You also spent time at Tsinghua University in Beijing. So what's your reaction to this announcement from Trump that basically is going to put tariffs on everything coming from China?
Well, the interesting thing is that the tensions between the U.S. and China are not limited to trade. Don't just look at the president's latest tweet. Go back and look at Vice President Pence's speech that he gave in October of last year, in which he outlined a whole host of areas in which the U.S. now sees China not just as a rival, certainly not as a partner, but actually as an adversary, as a foe.
Beijing is employing a whole-of-government approach to advance its influence and benefit its interests. It's employing this power in more proactive and coercive ways to interfere in the domestic policies of this country and to interfere in the politics of the United States.
There's some merit to some of the concerns that he expressed, but it means that even if they were able to resolve all the trade issues that are in front of them, the U.S.-China relationship would still be on a very rough path.
Right. When President Trump makes these announcements on Twitter, I mean, you've worked in China, you've taught there. How seriously does China take that?
It's interesting, you know, about how everyone takes it, because initially, president would tweet some angry tweet about General Motors, for instance, and the market would immediately react. And people have sort of learned to ignore that and say, okay, well, will it really translate into action? But right now, I mean, the tweet that he made yesterday about China was a policy tweet. I mean, it was a statement that the United States would, in fact, impose tariffs. And I don't think there's any way that you could not take that seriously. Mm.
I mean, how far is China willing to go, though, with their hardball stance based on a tweet?
So I doubt that China would actually impose retaliation until the U.S. tariffs went into effect. That's been sort of the way they played it all along. And China has its own economic difficulties. So I think they would like to tamp down any kind of trade sanctions that would negatively affect their economy. The question is China simply unwilling to give because it's intransigent and it doesn't want to change its ways? Or is it because it questions its negotiating partner? And I think increasingly in Beijing, at least, they're taking away the view that the United States would want to impose tariffs on China regardless of what China does. And that's a dangerous lesson for China to be taking away, because then it gives them very little incentive to play along.
And yet around this trade war and escalating tariffs, a bunch of other things have come into the discussion, from trade secrets and stolen patented information to soybean farming, fentanyl. What is this all really about?
So there's a lot on the table. For instance, U.S. has had security concerns about a telecom company in China called Huawei for many, many years. And so many things have been put onto the bargaining table that, short of a grand bargain, it's very difficult to resolve even issues that probably could be resolved between the United States and China.
Yeah, and as tensions increase, it's harder to imagine a win-win scenario. But can there be two winners in this trade war? Or eventually, will it just be two losers, or maybe even more than two losers?
There could be a win-win outcome, but the way that both sides are conceiving of it makes it very difficult. China, under Xi, has really not gone down the path of reform and opening that was promised. On the other hand, President Trump has all kinds of conceptions about trade being a big loser for the United States unless it's running a trade surplus. So you've got two sides which have conceptions of this conflict that lean more towards confrontation than towards resolution. And I think resolution is possible, but it requires disentangling a whole bunch of issues. But if we wrap them all up together in kind of a big tangle of Christmas tree lights, it's hard to untangle them.
Patrick Chovanec, Chief Strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.
If you come to the U.S. to study at an American college or university, you need a student visa. If you're in a field that requires on-the-job training, like the medical field, there's another type of visa you'll need. But international students who rely on that second category of visas say they're running into problems. Higher education reporter Kirk Carapeza, with our production partner WGBH in Boston, has been looking into this. First of all, Kirk, exactly what kind of visas are we talking about? Give us an example of who needs them.
Sure. These are called optional practical training, or OPT visas, and these allow college students or recent graduates to get training related to their education. That's the one requirement. And many visas go to science and medical students who work in hospitals or labs here in Boston and Cambridge. But you could also get one if you're a young journalist, you know, working here at WGBH.
So the name suggests that training is optional, is it?
In some cases, yes. Technically, it's optional. But administrators say these visas are critical to completing students' training. Think medical students and graduates trying to get practical experience in hospitals or labs.
So what's happening with these OPT visas, and why is it seen as kind of an obstacle right now?
Well, college administrators have been approaching me and saying that we're seeing new delays. These are outstanding delays in getting these visas, and the slowdowns have serious consequences. Immigration attorneys tell me the average wait time for an OPT visa is usually about 3 months or less, but we're now seeing applications pending 5 to 7 months.
Wow.
At Harvard, for example, more than 900 international students applied for visas in the winter back in February and March, but so far fewer than 400 have been approved. And that doesn't come without consequences for the local economy in Boston, for public health. Massachusetts General Hospital is Harvard's largest teaching hospital, and I spoke with Jay Vias. He's the residency program director. Vias says international residents from China to Canada have seen long visa processing delays.
Without their visa being approved by the federal government, they're not allowed to then move through the next stage of credentialing. If you're not credentialed, you can't take care of patients. And that has an immediate effect on our hospital.
And Marco, Vias says Americans should sit up and take note.
These residents have gone through an incredible selection process. These are people who, in the future, are going to cure cancer and are going to make incredible impacts in American medicine.
So what is causing these delays?
Well, a number of things, according to immigration attorneys. Just last year, the Trump administration eliminated this rule that said if the federal government did not approve your application within 90 days, you could just go to the local office here in Boston and get it approved. The administration also released this new policy that makes it much easier for international students to be charged with being in the U.S. illegally. And now there are growing concerns here in Boston and other college towns across the country of a kind of scientific McCarthyism kind of taking hold here.
I mean, those Harvard numbers are kind of stunning. Do you have a sense of how widespread this is and how many students, how many colleges and other institutions are being affected by these delays?
We don't have the total number, but it appears to be nationwide. It's not limited to selective colleges on the coast like Stanford and Harvard, but also some of the world's greatest public research universities in the middle of the country, schools like the University of Michigan and the University of Wisconsin. These are gems, and those states depend on these international students and these residents to make their communities better.
Do immigration officials have a plan to fix this, to unblock the backlog, and what's at stake if they don't?
Well, I reached out to the agency that issues these visas, United States Customs and Immigration Services, and a spokeswoman told me it's experiencing a surge in applications. She wouldn't quantify that surge, and she said there's, quote, a small backlog of cases that are pending beyond the standard 90-day processing time. The agency says it's implementing a plan to return to standard processing time soon, but academics I spoke with are pretty skeptical. Bill Kirby teaches China studies over at Harvard Business School, and he says even established scholars are experiencing delays, not just students and graduates.
I certainly don't know of any smoking gun, but I've seen it in practice. Highly reputable Chinese academics having difficulty getting what would ordinarily be routine visas to come to the United States being slow-walked.
If these delays continue, what's at stake here for American higher education and for the country?
What's at stake is its tradition and reputation for openness, for being a place in which the best in the world compete for the best slots in the best universities.
Higher education in the U.S. is one of the few industries where we still rank number one. And academics worry that if these slowdowns continue, if academics are being slow-walked, we're going to lose that ranking.
Kirk, how does this story about OPT visa backlogs kind of conform generally with the experience of being an international student under the Trump administration these days?
Well, I think there's this widespread perception of a less welcoming environment. And following President Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric during the campaign and now in office, we've seen a decline in international students over the past 2 years. While I was working on this story, Marco, a number of the international students affected by these policy changes were afraid to even talk to me on tape. So there is this fear out there. And they said getting a visa is an ongoing process. You need to apply and then reapply. So they're afraid of speaking out and being targeted by the administration. The sense I get is that there's a growing anxiety on campus, and the unpredictable process for obtaining visas only exacerbates that anxiety. We should note the Trump administration says international students are welcome here, but it also says colleges need to do a better job of integrating them on campus and protecting against intellectual property theft.
Kirk Carapezza with WGBH's Higher Education Desk here in Boston. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
These days, we're getting more and more accustomed to automated voices telling us what to do.
Okay, I'll remind you.
For many people, the accents of those voices really matter. Take Nigeria, for example. If you use Google Maps there, up until now, it was probably a British accent giving you directions.
Your destination will be on the right.
But now there's another option for Nigerians, a much more local-sounding one.
Your destination will be on the right.
Kola Tobosun is a speech linguist at Google Nigeria. He led the team that developed that new voice option, and he says it acts as a sort of equalizer for society.
Most of the people who drive in Nigeria, commercial drivers, are not usually at the top of the society. So they're not always the elite or the most educated or the most traveled. So they could understand fellow Nigerians, but when they get in the car and they have to drive, maybe as chauffeurs or Uber drivers or taxi drivers, and they hear a map that speaks in a foreign voice that doesn't know how to pronounce the street names, they might get confused when they want to turn left or turn right into particular streets. I know particular street names that I apply regularly, and I've heard many of those mangled pronunciations.
Do you have an example of a street name in Lagos that's been totally mangled?
Yes. There was a particular one, a street called Ajose, Adeogun, and people have said to me that they heard it pronounced as Ahose. Huh. Almost like a Spanish name,
right?
Because of the J. And so by creating a voice that actually understands how Nigerian names pronounce the phonology, then we can actually remove the confusion that have happened in the past.
It occurs to me, though, that it's got to be tricky to do that because there are more than 500 languages spoken in Nigeria. So, I mean, there isn't an agreed upon Nigerian accent per se, is there?
There is an accent that any Nigerian who hears would be able to say, well, that's a Nigerian accent.
So ultimately, you and the Google engineering team decided on this Nigerian accent. Let's hear it.
Walk west on Copperfield Street towards Great Suffolk Street.
What do you hear in that voice, Kola? I mean, and is it kind of an average mashup of Nigerian accents? Or, I mean, how did you go about deciding this was the right one?
My role as the project manager was to make sure that the eventual product represents as much of Nigeria as possible. It gives, you know, everybody kind of representation. And that's what I hear in the voice. It's a voice that doesn't quite belong to Yoruba or Igbo or Hausa, but it's a voice that can pronounce at least most of the names properly because of the training we have given to the creation of the voice. And the thoroughness we gave to the setting up of the team that made the voice happen.
Mm. So Google thinks this is going to increase interest in Google in Nigeria, and that'll lead to greater cell phone penetration and more profit, presumably, for Google. Do you see all that happening because there's now a Nigerian accented voice on Google Maps guiding drivers?
For me, as a linguist and somebody who cares about inclusion in technology, I believe that if more people can see themselves in technology, if it makes them more comfortable to use it, then more people are going to be able to use those products as well.
You're getting some complaints, though, too. What kind of concerns are users raising?
Technology has always, for most of us on this side of the continent, reflected, you know, a different kind of voice, a culture. So British English, American English. And for the first time, many people are actually seeing a Nigerian English voice. It's certainly possible that when people look at it, they say, why doesn't it represent exactly my own way of speaking? And it's hard to be able to reach that finality if you're trying to deal with a country of 190 million people. So what you can do is to get a voice that represents the most number of people. And to do that, you go with, you know, what most people can recognize and identify with. And that's what we've done here.
What do you think is the future for automated directions in Nigeria? Are we looking at a time where there's, you know, you can select from Kano accent or Lagos accent?
Well, that would be great. And the Nigerian English voice is a starting step. And in the future, it would be certainly possible that we have navigation in more regional accents or even in more local languages as well, as a way of bringing in even more people into using technology.
Kola Tobosun is a speech linguist at Google Nigeria. He led the team that developed the new Nigerian English option for the voice on Google Maps. And full disclosure, Google is one of our funders. Kola, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Climate change got some play at the Democratic presidential debates this week. Washington State Governor Jay Inslee has made it the centerpiece of his campaign.
We cannot work this out. The time is up. Our house is on fire. We have to stop using coal in 10 years. And we need a president to do it or it won't get done. Get off coal. Save this country and the planet. That's what I'm for.
Inslee might not survive for long as a serious contender for the nomination unless he can mount a big surge in the polls. But his climate-focused campaign does shine some light on the need to transition away from dirty fossil fuels and replace them with more renewables like solar and wind. Solar has made huge leaps in recent years. Think of all the solar panels you now see on roofs. But there's still a major hang-up. Solar panels only work when the sun is shining. Here's where battery storage comes in. That technology is also advancing. Better batteries mean it really doesn't matter when the sun's not out, and the power plants of the 21st century could be our homes. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
In Kenya, the electric grid is notoriously unreliable.
If you're watching a Champions League soccer game and, you know, the grid goes down in the middle of the game, you know, that's not a good outcome.
And that outcome, it happens a lot.
At least once a day.
Colin LeDuc is trying to prevent that. He's a partner at Generation Investment Management, a London-based firm that finances green companies. One of the firm's co-founders, former Vice President Al Gore. LeDuc's firm is investing in a Kenyan company called M-Copa, which installs solar panels coupled with lithium-ion batteries to supply modest amounts of power to homes. And they're not just targeting customers who lose power during soccer matches.
There are obviously areas of Kenya where there is no grid at all.
There's a problem, though. Affordability. LeDuc says M-Copa leases its solar systems for the same cost as a daily supply of kerosene or wood.
So 50 cents a day for the solar system. And then what typically happens is they will pay that for about a year. And by that stage, they would have paid off the solar system.
M-Copa has about 1 million customers in Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda.
You know, if you think about solar penetration in the U.S., the U.S. is far behind Kenya relatively just because of the strength of the existing grid in the U.S.
In the U.S., we don't really need big batteries in our garages. We have a reliable electricity grid. That said, more and more U.S. homeowners are giving it a go. For some Californians, it's for similar reasons as for Kenyans. The California utility Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, says it may temporarily shut off some high-voltage lines as part of a new wildfire safety protocol. And rolling blackouts could be possible for up to 5 million California customers.
And we just don't want to deal with that.
I met Susie Poulos at a coffee shop in Berkeley near her home. During the day, her new rooftop solar panels make energy, and at night she can use that energy stored in the batteries to help power her home. Poulos was also motivated to install solar-powered batteries for environmental reasons.
The current world, the climate change, yeah, absolutely.
Poulos recently began leasing a system from the Bay Area company Sunrun and has seen her electricity bills decrease dramatically.
Just for electricity, we usually paid about $150 and we now pay $10.
That's to pay for a connection to the grid. Now, Poulos does pay Sunrun $120 a month to lease her system. Still, she's saving $20 a month and supplying clean energy into California's electricity mix. I recently saw Sunrun's Vice President for Energy Services, Audrey Lee, speak at MIT's Energy Conference in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
So I'll start off by asking all of you a question. How many of you have used Airbnb as either a host or as a guest? Raise your hand.
Lee envisions solar batteries at home as another iteration of the sharing economy, this time sharing electricity. Lee says while the cost of generating power is declining, the cost to deliver it is going up.
And by 2030, the electricity utility industry will need to make a total investment of $1.5 to $2 trillion in order to maintain this electricity grid. So to me, it doesn't make sense. Why are we transporting electricity large distances when it costs so much to do so, when we can just generate that electricity at the home where it's being used in the first place?
Since 2010, the cost to install solar panels has gone down by nearly two-thirds, and batteries have fallen in price by 84%. Still, the solar storage revolution may just be getting started.
Energy storage, of course, has, you know, come a long way. Today it's considered to be sort of the sexy thing in the world of energy, but it's still a fairly new technology.
I caught up with Ravi Mangani in the hallway at the MIT conference. He's with the energy research firm Wood Mackenzie. He says the U.S. is a leader when it comes to solar-powered batteries, but we need better state policies to encourage more homes and businesses to install them.
There are some other countries that have done extensive work on energy storage, and we've seen deployments in those countries, namely South Korea, the United Kingdom, and now increasingly China as well.
Mangani says in the past 5 years, the world began to experiment with storage. In the next five, it will become a key asset for the electricity grid and is projecting it to grow by more than 13-fold worldwide. For the world, I'm Jason Margolis.
Earlier today, I had one of those remarkable moments here in the studio.
Oh, I'm so happy I finally meet you.
I watched two cousins meet for the first time, and even though their bond is tangled up in one of the most horrific chapters in American history, they were celebrating. On Monday, we're going to bring you the story of Jean Kapenda, who grew up in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He's been interested in genealogy for a long time and set out to meet his African-American relatives.
Now, the most important thing for African-Americans is to connect with an African.
So, a few years ago, Jean Kapenda did one of those cheek swabs and learned through a genetic testing site that he had relatives in the Americas, most of them ancestors of people enslaved and sent on ships across the ocean. Today, in this very studio, he met a few of those long-lost cousins. For Ayanna Lakes, her mother and son, it was a reckoning with a rich past.
Our history doesn't begin and end with slavery. Our first conversations had nothing to do with slavery. Mm-hmm. It had everything to do with your tribe is full of strength and riches, and slavery was just a blip in the radar. Mm-hmm. And I wish that we as African Americans and, you know, scholars would teach more of the power that comes out of Africa versus just the slave trade.
Ayanna's mother, Audrey Spencer, saw this as an important moment for her grandson.
I feel good to know now that my grandson will be able to actually say a tribe that he, that means me too, am connected to. And I can actually say, no, I am from
Lunda tribe.
Lunda tribe, where I have been told so many times, you have no country.
Piecing together an extended family torn apart by slavery, you'll want to be here for that Monday on The World. Our theme music was composed by Ned Porter from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend, everybody.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.